Good morning, everyone. I want to welcome you to the ITIF ESI Smackdown. And it should be a lot of fun and no holes barred, a polite and respectful debate on the question of should we pick winners and losers. And I want to also thank our co-host here, Clyde Prestowitz with the Economic Strategy Institute. This is an event that's co-sponsored by both ITIF and ESI. And now it is my pleasure to turn it over to our moderator this morning, who we really couldn't have asked for a better moderator for this topic. Most of you know Jim Fallows or his work. Jim is a national correspondent for The Atlantic and really is, I think, one of the most thoughtful commentators on the state of the U.S. economy today. He's written a number of pieces on this in the last 2 years, which have been, I think, very, very insightful. He's been at The Atlantic for more than 25 years, just got back from a stint in China for, it must have been four or five?
Seemed like that, but three.
It seemed like a lot. He spent 2 years as a chief White House speechwriter for President Jimmy Carter, 2 years as editor of U.S. News and World Report. He's also a program designer at Microsoft, and he's also an instrument-rated private pilot. So with that, we'll turn it over to Jim. Thank you.
Thank you, Rob. Thanks to all our participants here. Thank you all for coming out this morning. I am really looking forward to this event. We know that in the world of public policy, there are issues that come and go, and there will be long, eternal divisions of opinion and values that people have. I think we have a chance with four of the leading proponents and thinkers and practitioners on the issue that's before us this morning to have a formal, structured debate. I'm sure that everybody in this room has heard issues of industrial policy, whether it's feasible or not, or desirable or not, discussed over the years, probably by some of the people we'll be hearing from this morning. I don't think we've ever heard it examined in just this way, because we're going to have a formal, good, clean, fight-style, structured debate. For those of you who have grown a little hazy on this since your days as college debaters, I will remind you. We're going to do it by the following rules. We're going to have first a 6-minute opening statement by the affirmative team, the team supporting the proposition that the U.S. government can and should pick winners, by which we mean the government should rely not only on the market, but also by setting a comprehensive national strategy for boosting competitiveness, et cetera. And here the proposition defended by the affirmative team. We'll have a 6-minute statement by the first affirmative. We then will have a 3-minute question period of the presenter by one of the negative team, followed by the negative opening statement, 6 minutes, 3 minutes Q&A, and on through the whole process. We'll then have a rebuttal round. As in courtroom proceedings, since the burden of proof is on the affirmative will have both the first and the last word. So we'll have a double negative segment in the middle, and you'll see. I will be keeping time on the speakers as they make their presentations. I'll be sitting here conveniently in their eye line. And whenever any of them has 1 minute to go, either on an opening presentation or a Q&A, I'll hold up a 1 minute signal. When there are 0 minutes to go, I will stand up and come back up here to the podium. And although it means a lot of stage business, we'll have the people doing the speaking do so from here. And then after the debate portion is over, we'll have some questions and discussions. We'll have it casually just sitting here, panel style. I'll say only a word about each of our speakers today, because I believe you know. You certainly know of them. You probably know them, too, from over the years. One of our hosts is Clyde Prestowitz of the Economic Strategy Institute. Clyde and I have first met in Japan 25 years ago or so, when you already were talking about having a worldview on what was going wrong between Japan, U.S., and the rest of the world. So Clyde has been a very influential author of countless books. Rob Atkinson, who is also our host here from ITIF, has been very influential in recent debates about how the industries of the future can be affected by the interaction of market and state policy. Robert Z. Lawrence of the Kennedy School is somebody who I have listened to and learned from over the years. He's had the earliest, most influential writings about where the benefits of trade and trade policy really did fall, whether it was in which ways it was productive and not for states to intervene. And Claude Barfield, the American Enterprise Institute, has also been an influential voice of reasoned skepticism of the kind of proposition we're hearing this morning. So that is the lineup of speakers you will hear. I couldn't imagine four more well-matched heavyweight contenders in the policy and intellectual sense. As physical specimens, they're all trim and models to us all, but as contenders, they are the heavyweights we're looking for. We're going to have an additional tone of excitement here of voting to see whether minds are changed during the course of the debate. So Steve Norton is going to come up and tell you how the voting system works. He's going to vote before the discussion on how you feel about the proposition, and then after the formal debate, you're going to vote on how you feel then and see whether there was any marginal movement one way or the other. So would you tell us, Steve, please, about the process?
Well, it's really, you use the mic because we've got people watching online.
It's pretty straightforward, we hope. This is the instructions. There are basically three ways to cast your vote. You can, if I see some of you have laptops, and I know some folks watching the live stream, can go to the website, poll4.com. And probably the easiest way, if anybody has their BlackBerry or handheld device, is just to send a text message. And what you will do is you'll see, I can't see the number, what is it, 95? That's the one, okay? And then you will cast your vote. You see where it says agree, disagree, unsure? There's numbers at the bottom. You use that number as your response code. So what I would do is invite you to cast your votes now, and you will see on the screen how people decide what people's inclination is right now. And so while you're doing that, we can maybe get on with the debate, and then maybe 10 minutes before the end, we'll do the same with a post-debate poll to see if anybody's minds change.
Yes, and just as I've encouraged our protagonists here to have a good, clean fight, I will encourage everybody to cast a good, clean, honest vote. That is, while we're going to look for movement, please honestly state what your views are now so we can see whether they have honestly changed as time goes on. So that is the plan. And I believe, Rob, you're going to go first. So leading off with a 6-minute first affirmative presentation, I give you Rob Atkinson.
All right, well, thank you, Jim. I want to start by saying that what is essentially an ideological statement put forth principally by neoclassical economists that the U.S. should not pick winners, really at the end of the day, only serves to stop and not advance the kind of reasoned analysis and discussion we have to have in this country about what our economic and technology policy needs to be. So essentially, this whole notion of picking winners and losers is designed to stop serious thought. Let me suggest that before I say why we do need to pick winners and losers, or why we need to pick winners, that we need to think about what the continuum is. On the one hand, there's a continuum of doing nothing, or leaving it up to the market, because the market is all wise and leads to Pareto optimality and everything's going to work. To something next, which would be supporting what you could call factor conditions. In other words, it's the role of government is to help with things like a good science base and helping with funding researchers and the like. To a third piece, which would be to pick key technologies and industries that we think are going to be important for the nation. That's essentially the position that Clyde and I will take today, that we do think we should and can pick winning technologies and winning industries, and that's important for the future of our country. There's a fourth step, which I think Clyde and I would say is not appropriate, and that's you don't want to go so far down the path of picking that you end up doing what some of the Europeans and Asians have done, of picking individual national champions, nor do you want to go so far down on the technology spectrum that you're picking very, very narrow technologies to preclude other types of technology. So, for example, we would argue we need a national battery policy. But we don't know what the right battery technology is going to be. So a battery technology policy wouldn't pick lithium batteries only. It would be a broad scope of saying we think batteries are critical to the future of this country. We need a battery technology. So why do we need to pick winners? The basic bottom line is that some industries and technologies are more important than others. They drive innovation, they drive exports, they drive productivity, and they support high wages more than others. This is essentially stating that there is a fundamental difference between computer chips and potato chips. A dollar of potato chips is not equal to a dollar of computer chips. The computer chips are worth a lot more. But in the market only, if we rely only on the market, we'll get potato chips and computer chips. We get more computer. If we get more potato chips, we get fat. If we get more computer chips, we get rich. The big difference. Okay, so why do we need to do this? Why won't the market do this? Essentially, I would argue neoclassical economists, and I assume our opponents this morning, oppose picking winners because the right industrial structure, the right technology structure, is one that the market provides. Because by definition, market exchanges, price-intermediated market exchanges, are what are called Pareto optimal. You can't make anybody better off because each party into the transaction is better off. But that assumes, as we like to know, let's say in economics, economics is all about assumption. It assumes a whole set of things which just aren't true. And in fact, there are a set of market failures, or what other types of market, like externalities, that are endemic to the economy, and they're endemic particularly to high-tech industries and high-tech markets. But let me just mention a few of these. Benefit spillover. So we all know that research spills over and that companies can't capture all of it. But there are spillovers that are different by different types of technology. So just assuming that they're going to be the same, certain technologies have vast spillovers, others have less. IT investment, for example, there's very good work by Lauren Hitt at Penn that shows that for every dollar that a company invests in IT, society gets another dollar. So because of that, economies will underinvest in IT because of that spillover. The whole notion of general purpose technologies, which a lot of economists have talked about, technologies that are imbued throughout the economy that drive productivity and growth in many, many sectors, and in particularly IT, there's a whole slew of research that shows that GPTs have 4 to 5 times more impact than regular technologies. And so if we rely on the market, we're going to underinvest in general purpose technologies. There are a whole set of other market failures, time horizons. And it's pretty clear that US companies have shifted their time horizons to much more shorter market time horizons, and because of that, they're doing less basic and applied research. There's a whole set of time horizons around first mover advantages. If companies can get a first mover advantage, they're able to gain, bring down prices, get innovation, and as a result, gain market share. We shouldn't be indifferent to that kind of dynamic. Other types of market failures, chicken or egg externalities, chicken or egg network externalities, whole technologies like digital signatures, mobile payments, high-speed broadband, intelligent transportation systems, health IT, these are all technologies that one individual firm cannot do, or in a very difficult way, do on its own. It's these technologies to emerge in the marketplace are dependent upon other actors acting at the same time. So you have a whole set of coordination failures. Cluster externalities. In regional clusters around the country, the benefits of one firm doing better spill over to all the firms in that cluster. We don't account for that solely in the market. And finally, high wage, high value added economic base. There's this notion in neoclassical economics, we don't need to pick winners and losers because the market will get us there. Because what we want is what's called equilibrium. There's a lot of new evidence, particularly a very nice study by an economist, Elvio Acelini, which finds that in a neoclassical you can have two equilibriums, one
high wage, Mr. Atkinson.
One low wage. So that's why we need to pick winners and losers, win winners, because the market is not going to do it for us.
Thank you. Now, you may stand at the podium for your 3-minute cross-examination by Mr. Barfield.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I basically have two questions. We're supposed to do the question and the answer.
Yes, you can both. No, just stand up. You're having a college wait.
Is that correct? One, and this has been in your writings and others of your ilk as for, this whole business about neoclassical economics, it seems to me that it's not just neoclassical economics. You're taking on the entire economics profession, with certain minor exceptions. So I'd like you to explain how neoclassical economists fit with larger economists. A second, and I should say that I don't know what you call Robert Solow a neoclassical economist or whatever, But in terms of what you just laid out here, Solow famously said this, I mean, several decades ago, you know, I know that there are technologies and sectors where there are spillovers, where society, there's big spillovers, and that where society would gain a lot more if we could just invest it. But my problem is, I don't know which ones they are. And I think more recently, Jagdish Bhagwati in a book said, well, you know, we economists don't know where the spillovers are, but it, but private interest groups think they know, and they will tell the government. So how do you, by what means have you decided on this list? We've had lists of strategic technologies for the last 20 years. How does one decide? How can you tell? You've listed a whole group.
Sure, no. Look, I think the problem with economics is that the notion that neoclassical economics is defined as economics by neoclassical economists. There are, in fact, a whole set of other schools of thought in economics, such as endogenous, what people call endogenous growth theory, neo-Schumpeterianism, institutional economics, evolutionary economics, Richard Nelson's work at Columbia, for example. So in that sense, yes, I am targeting the neoclassical framework, but there's a whole set of other people who are doing economics that have a distinctly different view that is not sort of market-based, but rather institution-based, and I think that's a big difference. With regard to Solow, I mean, look, Solow did a lot of amazing work, but within the neoclassical framework, one of the great quotes from Robert Solow is, innovation is manna from heaven. That only thing that meant was he has no clue about innovation. He doesn't really know how it comes, so it must come from heaven. Clearly, innovation is not manna from heaven. Clearly, innovation is something that we do. And how do we know what to do? Well, one way we do it is we rely on research. So there are a whole set of studies out there about types of technologies that have big impact. So I'm more than happy to say definitively right now, we do know that IT has a bigger impact than non-IT. We do know, for example, that we're going to need clean energies in the future. So I agree, it's not a science, but certainly we can use informed analysis to figure out what are the general areas that we need to do as a society.
We have 10 seconds if you have any closing point you'd like to make.
I would only say that, you know, you take Richard Nelson as an institutionalist opposed to neoclassical, I don't know what he would call himself, but he is against the same skepticism of the kind of intervention you've talked to throughout his career. He's hardly a market fundamentalist system.
To be continued. We now have our first negative presentation from Robert Lawrence for 6 minutes.
And I'll give you five and two countdowns here.
Well, thank you. It's a real pleasure to renew this debate. Firstly, I want to make it clear, I teach economics. And I've just been teaching a trade policy course. And in the first two lectures, I explain a competitive market. After that, I explain what happens when a market has imperfections. So this whole idea that somehow economists are blind to the imperfections of markets, regardless of how you classify them, is totally absurd. It does not represent any kind of academically significant thinking. We have spent a lot of time thinking about market imperfections and market failures. The real debate between us is not whether the market is perfect or not, or whether there isn't some role for government, but rather, what should that role for government be? And in my view, and in our view, there is a role legitimately for the government, in particular, in providing the public goods, which the private market will not provide on its own. And if we talk about the area in which we are focusing on, technology. Clearly, the government, and our government has significant deficits, has to improve our infrastructure for technology. The physical infrastructure of this country is degraded. That's a legitimate role for government. The government has to provide regulatory frameworks. Ours, clearly in the financial area, have been broken. We need to restructure our financial sector so that the investments being made are focused not simply on financial engineering, but on real engineering. So these are legitimate challenges, and we are in favor of them. Now let's take research and development. Particularly as you get to the commercial end, the government doesn't have the foggiest idea where the future technologies are going to pay off commercially. Ultimately, our goal here is pay off commercially. We have the most advanced system of venture capitalists, of financial institutions that are exploring where commercial payoffs will come. That is not a role for the government. Now, the government can use tools to deal with the market failures. So let me give you an example. We do know that a private market will underperform in research and development because private entrepreneurs cannot capture the full benefits. Rob gave us the example of information technology. So think about an R&D tax credit. An R&D tax credit does not pick technologies. It simply enhances the very activity that we are trying to encourage. That's the right approach. Let the market respond, but create an incentive system that aligns public and private incentives. Let me give you another example, which is energy policy. Energy policy. Well, here's my energy policy. Let us promise, let us set as the government, ensure that the price of CO2 is going to rise over time. Let's make sure that it starts at $10 a ton, it's going to be $100 a ton in 5 years' time, and we can guarantee that using either a cap and trade system or a tax. And that's enough, because when our private sector appreciates that the price of R&D, that the price of CO2 is going to rise, and we give them certainty about that, they will go off and decide whether it's biofuels, or whether it's conservation, or whether it's nuclear, or whether it's wind. Instead, what we have is a government that is sticking its fingers into a multiplicity of technologies where it doesn't have the foggiest idea about where the major payoffs are going to come. So the bottom line is, let's create incentives, the right system of incentives, for the private sector to search and respond. That is what America does best. So the debate between us on the should question is whether the government should be involved in isolating these technologies, or whether the private sector should be responding to the right set of investments. Clyde will continue our onslaught by asking the question of whether our government in the United States actually can implement the policies that they are advocating, even assuming it should.
Thank you. So a 3-minute interrogation from one of a member of your team.
One of the things that I love about Bob Lawrence is he's a closet industrial policy. Really on our side. Bob, you agree that the government should, to some extent, get in this game with investment tax credits or R&D tax credits, funding research, etc. But the crunch question really comes, in a way, after the initial innovation. Andy Grove has just developed a neat set of graphs that shows that the U.S. is very good at doing startups. But what happens is then that when it comes time to scale up, the U.S. falls out of bed. And one of the reasons it falls out of bed is because other countries take an initial idea and really push it. China right now is pushing photovoltaic cells, for example. We used to be the leader in that. We're not anymore. China is pushing it. We stopped pushing it. So the question really is this. Once your R&D has paid off, you have innovation, and then another country comes along with an industrial policy targeting that, providing capital subsidies, protection, etc., would you have the U.S. government respond in some fashion?
Clyde, you asked a very good question. So we have the technology. Now the question is, where should we manufacture? That does require an environment in which the manufacturers think it's attractive to locate in the United States. So we have to make the United States an attractive place to locate manufacturing. Now, we saw We didn't invent the fine cars, the fine small cars that the Japanese did, but they decided to come here and to manufacture in the United States because they thought the economics made sense. So I'm not averse to the idea that we create an environment which is attractive as a location for manufacturing. That would require an exchange rate that is competitively valued, that would require tax policies, certain regulatory policies, and then I want those firms to make the decisions on a profit basis. I don't want the government interfering and trying to force firms to produce in one location or another. Because at the end of the day, what we've seen is a fragmentation of the global production chain. And products today no longer have identities, national identities. Technologies do not have national identities. The global supply chain, effectively being exploited, requires firms to be free to choose where the different segments of the production activity will be located. So this idea that the government should somehow be inducing the firms who innovate to locate something here, I think goes beyond their legitimate competence.
And with that, we now move seamlessly to the second affirmative presentation. So, it's time for Clyde's actual presentation. So this is a 6-minute presentation and followed by a questioning of Clyde.
Well, I want to make two or three key points. First is that governments really cannot avoid industrial policy. They have to make choices. They have armies and navies. They have telecommunications systems. They have healthcare systems. They have budgets. They have to decide how they're going to spend the funds. NIH spends more money on biotech research than the rest of the world combined. Many universities and many startup companies are wholly dependent upon NIH. Somebody at NIH has to decide where the money goes, and there has to be some criteria to do that, and NIH seems to do it pretty well. Think about the spectrum. We have a Federal Communication Commission that has to allocate the radio telegraphic spectrum. Has to be choices. And those choices will determine industrial structure. Think about the Federal Reserve. Maybe you don't want to think about it these days. It was a failure of industrial policy that led, in part, to the economic crisis that we've been suffering. So I think you really can't avoid it. And the question then, and Bob asked the right question, how does the government decide? And the trick here then, because you can have bad industrial policies, you can have good industrial policies. The trick is, okay, how do you develop the criteria to get to make the right kinds of choices? Other governments, as I pointed out, do have policies. Other governments really don't have this debate. China has a full-blown industrial policy. Singapore, Taiwan, Germany, virtually all the other developed countries have it except the U.S., the Anglos, the U.S. and the U.K. Now, here's the interesting thing. I was in a White House discussion recently in which the question was, how do we achieve development and growth in green technologies here in the U.S.? Particularly, the question was, how do we revitalize the middle class and how do we revitalize the Midwest? And can we take some of those auto parts plants that have been closing up and turn them into windmill factories or photovoltaic cell factories or what have you? One team of White House advisors argued, yeah, we can, and let's have some government programs to fund development of wind generation, what have you. But another group said, wait. Actually, the Danes and the Germans and the Japanese and the Koreans are ahead of us in this technology. We'd be better off just buying the batteries and windmills from them and getting those inexpensive components and then just providing the energy to our consumers. And so there was this big debate, and the one side was saying we need to leave this to market forces. Now the question is, what are the market forces here? Germany, Denmark, Japan, Korea, Taiwan are subsidizing heavily those technologies. So the market is the government, the industrial policies of those countries. And I submit that that is not a decision not to respond to those policies. It's a decision by the United States not to be in the production and the development of the future technology of those industries. Now, the funny thing is that the United States has, for most of its history, been a strong supporter of industrial policy. The myth that the U.S. got rich on the basis of free markets and entrepreneurial virtuosity is just that, a myth. The founding fathers were well aware of Adam Smith and rejected it. They chose the American system. They chose the Transcontinental Railroad. Woodrow Wilson at Versailles found the Brits were reading his mail. He called his Secretary of the Navy, a guy named Franklin Roosevelt, said, "Frank, we need a company that can beat British Marconi so the Brits don't read my telegraph traffic." Franklin Roosevelt called in the heads of AT&T, United Fruit, Westinghouse, and GE, and said, "Guys, we're going to form a company to beat British Marconi. The U.S. Navy is going to own 50% of it." And they did. And the name of that company is RCA. The U.S. government ran a huge industrial policy during the First and Second World Wars and achieved dominance in industry and technology as a result of it. Now, today, the U.S. has an industrial policy. Our de facto industrial policy is this. We subsidize agriculture, the banking system. We favor travel by air and by road over rail. We heavily support medical research. We support, we subsidize consumption. And we effectively have decided by acquiescing in foreign industrial policies, we've decided effectively to move the production of tradable goods and the provision of tradable services offshore. That's our industrial policy. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, one of the negative team, a three-minute questioning of Clyde.
So, Clyde, you gave us this example of the green technology that was being discussed in the White House. And one of the concerns that I have in both the presentations is what exactly is the goal? What do we mean by a winner? You see, in the discussion you described, some people wanted to restore the Midwest. Some people liked the idea of wind technology. Some people like the idea of high-wage industries. Some people want to create high-value-added industries. So what are precisely the criteria that we're going to look for in these technologies? You see, the point is, if we don't know precisely what we're looking for, how do we ever know whether we have succeeded or failed? So if you came up to me, if you give me a precise definition of what your goal is, then I'm going to be able to know what a winner is. So my question is, what is the precise nature of your goal that will judge whether the policy is successful or not?
Well, in that particular case, there were several criteria. One was revitalizing the Midwest, creating jobs. One was creating good jobs, high value-added, high-paying jobs. The second criteria was maintaining a competitive U.S. Technological base. The feeling being that if we're not doing research in a number of these technologies, we're not going to be having students studying those things. And so the knowledge base will be the innovation ecostructure will deteriorate. And so the thought being proposed was that these are technologies, photovoltaic cells, wind generators, batteries in which the U.S. has in the past been competitive, in which it has strong capabilities, in which there's no reason that it cannot be competitive in the future, and these industries provide high-wage, high-value-added jobs, and they support the R&D for a competitive technological base. And therefore, why not, since the market is being distorted by foreign industrial policies, why not at least respond to that distortion so that the market forces will allow American entrepreneurialism and innovativeness to do what it has always done? Why not?
One of the deep insights of neoclassical economics is that each goal you have, if you have a goal, you need an instrument. You cannot hit a target if you have more than two targets, you need two arrows. So the point is, the deep insight is, if you have more than one objective, you need more than one instrument. What I heard was a multiplicity of objectives. You saw the Midwest create high-value jobs, etc., etc. The assumption is somehow if we get the technology, it's going to give us all those other good things. I question that because it seems to me it's too diffuse. If you want to restore the Midwest, have a regional policy.
It is time for this segment. We now have the final one of the opening presentations, the second negative by Claude Barclay, for 6 minutes.
Robert basically talked about whether we should do this. And the second question is whether we can do this. And I have to say that I have spent a lot of time more than just the economics of this or the politics of domestic policy. But the first thing I edited what's called the politics of domestic policy. And some of these issues have been around for a long time. And I was really reminded of that as I was looking at material the last couple of days and came across a very recent, last 2 months, I think it was 3 months, piece by Jeff Faw, some of you may have seen this, in the Economic Policy Institute, which really goes back into history, and I'm going to take 10 seconds on this, in which he basically blames, it's called the road not taken, or the road, long road taken, or something like that. He goes back and blames all of our problems in terms of a non-industrial policy on the Carter administration and Charlie Schultz, the head of the Council of Economic Advisors, which he said, in conjunction, by the way, and this rings today, with Wall Street, headed off other members of the Carter administration, other economists, as it were, in their push for an industrial policy. And the point I suggest you read, the point that I want to make here is that the way he approached this, and this gets me to the point of the question of can, was wholly as a question of competing interest groups. And he saw this really as a question not so much of national policy or national interests, but you would have competing interest groups. And that, I think, is one of the problems that the United States particularly will face in any industrial policy. And by this, we'll come back to this. Clyde talked about a lot of general policy. We're talking today about picking winners and losers in specific companies or technologies, depending on how you define it. And there, I would argue that we now have, and it's true on Republicans and Democrats, and it certainly hasn't changed with the new rules of the Supreme Court about money in politics, it's certainly not going to change the most highly developed interest groups, say, in the history of the world, certainly among democracies. And so the idea, we are not then ruled by philosopher kings. We are also not ruled by a bureaucracy, whether it's in the Commerce Department or the Defense Department or whoever, who actually has the beginning or the final say in what we actually do. We still have the Iron Triangle. We still have the combination of a committee chairman and a private interest group and a bureaucracy. And we have seen that, actually, just to get specific to industrial policy, in many cases, and we're about to see it again, in terms of energy. Think back to the debates of energy in the late 1970s, leading to the Energy Security Corporation, which actually, the way it was set up, would be to spread goods all over the country. Indeed, that to go back to Charlie Schultz, one of the criticism that Charlie Schultz had of Laura Tyson's book, which he came back a decade later to push industrial policy, was that really our record here goes back to what we did in the Model Cities program, a very different program. But it started out to target the worst poverty region, or the worst poverty portions of cities, and you picked three cities. By the time the Congress got through it, we had 180 cities. And that, I think, will give you some sense of if we go forward in terms of as a widespread program. Yes, small programs. Maybe some of the SBIR, though there are other, the Small Business Innovation Program, though there are other problems with that, could slip under the, let's say, under the transom, because you wouldn't have. But when you get to a larger program, you are going to kick in a whole series of interests. And the, Robert's point about guaranteeing a price, I think that any guarantee, whether it's a price or whatever, given our political system, would not have credibility. And that has been the problem, I think, in the public energy programs, because corporations, no matter what particular energy technology they're pushing, know that they cannot count on the government to pursue the policy. There's one other final thing in this opening segment that I'd like to say, and that is Rob Atkinson has talked about the fact that I think it's a caricature, and Robert Lawrence, I think, began to rebut this, that some of our neoclassical economists think that technology springs full-blown just from investment in basic research. I would suggest that has not been true for decades. The work we did, as I mentioned, Dick Nelson for us and Nathan Rosenberg, saw in the late 70s, early 80s already that the process, the so-called linear process of innovation was not accurate. But that presents a worse problem, I think, for the government. Because now we know that it's a highly complex and very technical, technologically specific process. And what you do in one technology would not work in another technology. So that presents, I think, major problems for a government, and this is, I'm talking about even honest and highly trained bureaucrats, to decide where the intervention will be. In fact, it's the complexity, not the simplicity, the inaccurate one that Rob Atkinson has put forward, I think, which really presents a problem. I'll just stop.
Great. Thank you very much. So we now have a 3-minute questioning of Claude, and then we'll move into the rebuttal round, which I'll explain after 3 minutes is done.
All right. Well, first of all, I actually do blame Charlie Schulz for much of where we are.
Poor Charlie. He's such a great guy.
He may be a great guy.
He's another part, but he's a great guy.
He may be a great guy, but he's emblematic of the kind of neoclassical thinking that got us down this path. You raised essentially two common complaints. We can't do it because of complexity. We can't do it because of politicization. First of all, I have to say, by the way, Dick Nelson's recent book, Institutions and Economic Growth, I encourage you to read the chapter on Taiwan, where he clearly states the reason Taiwan got rich was because they picked technologies. Talking about politicization, the Taiwanese Research Institute, whatever the formal name of it is one of the most effective institutions in the world. Those people are incredibly smart. They've got a whole cadre of people. They have picked technologies, and they've gotten the Taiwanese economy moving up. So I guess two points. One is this whole notion of politicization. It's already politicized. We do things, and you go look at the tax code, it's chock full of terrible, terrible tax provisions. Because some lobbyist goes over to the Hill and gets it in there, and there's nobody fighting back. If we had a real strategy and a real set of experts in this country, and by the way, if we had neoclassical economists who stood up and said, wait a minute, this is bad industrial policy, this is good industrial policy, and used your analytical capabilities to say what's right and what's wrong, I think we could actually do the right thing. The problem is the debates just don't do anything. So there's very little research, there's very little analytical support that can go to help policymakers do this. I would commend you to look at a piece by Richard Lipsey, a wonderful economist, a non-neoclassical economist, and Richard surveyed the world and said, what do we know about what works and what doesn't work? So that's quantitative research, and we do know. So I guess, this last point that nobody buys, that I'm caricaturizing neoclassical economics. I actually don't think I am, but for the sake of argument, let's say I am. The problem is that the people in Washington who have taken courses or read articles or whatever, they characterize it. I was in a meeting recently where I was arguing that we need a tax policy that explicitly promotes innovation. And the response I got from a Treasury economist was, that's picking winners and losers. We all know that Robert Solow said technology is manna from heaven. So they at least believe it. And the reason they believe it is because no one's arguing against it.
Well, I guess on the first point about we have other bad policies, and so it seems to me what you're arguing is just we have other bad policies, so what's wrong with just having another bad policy? I just don't buy that. And you've got to let's get back to the specifics that you were talking about in terms of picking winners and losers. As Robert Lawrence started, and I continue, it's not that I don't think the government should do nothing. There are lots of things the government should do, lots of things that you have suggested in your recent testimony that I don't disagree with. But we're talking today about specific technologies or groups of technologies. And there, I think I will go back to my original point, is that given the politics of this, and even if you had, in your terms, a neoclassical economist who would stand up and say this, I mean, for God's sake, whether it's Charlie Schulz or or whoever else is head of the Council of Economic Advisors, they are not very large political forces in any White House.
Can I get a 30-second response?
No, you don't.
So now we're going to move into a rebuttal stage, and I'm going to give our contestants a moment to pause and collect their thoughts and explain the ground rules here. So again, the premise is the affirmative bears the burden of proof, so they went first, they're going to go last. So we're going to hear now in the rebuttal round, first from a negative speaker again. And these are 4-minute segments with no question and answer. So we're going to hear a negative, an affirmative, a negative, and an affirmative. And the goal here is that any of the issues that we've been drawing out on our debate maps, things that have not been addressed directly, are supposed to be addressed and wrapped up in this final round of rebuttals. So this is, we're going to have, we start with a negative rebuttal round for 4 minutes by whichever speaker would like to go first. So here's our negative rebuttal.
So let me start by saying that I do believe there is a role for the government in generating research, basic research. And in addition, the government has the National Science Foundation, and it gives large grants, and it can steer some of those grants to areas where independent panels believe there are opportunities and there are payoffs, and there may well be commercial and innovative payoffs. So I am not averse to a policy which promotes research and even research into technological opportunities. What Clyde said that really worries me, though, is that it is clear that the concern is not simply that, but it is rather that these technologies actually result in being applied within the United States. And that's where I take issue, because it seems to me that if we're going to try to ensure that, we're going to have to take a lot of action, both through trade policies and through other policies, in order to make sure that that happens. And let's ask ourselves, who ultimately is responsible, for instance, for trade policy? It's the Congress of the United States. So it may well be, and Rob gave us a vision in which the experts somehow decide how the resources are going to be spent. Actually, if we could do that, I would think that the policy might be worth trying. But we can't do that in the United States, given our Constitution and given the way we allocate financial resources, because they go through a political system. And that political system has evidenced an inability to behave strategically. Let's look, for instance, at our policies. We had a real strategic threat after 9/11, right? Homeland security. And so the question was, what is the optimal way to spend our resources with respect to homeland security? What happened? Well, the Congress decided the most threatened areas. Firstly, they had to divide it up among the 50 states. And so we have Peoria being singled out as a strategic threat, as a possible being subject to a strategic threat. We could not prioritize. The Model Cities Program is another example. We have to be able to prioritize if we're going to give large resources to this strategy. Can we drop the losers in a political system? It's not only about picking winners. It has to also be about dropping losers. How well can a political system drop the losers? And can we sustain the policies? Are we going to have a stable environment? You know, it could happen that this administration decides on something, but the question is, what will the next administration do? That was the experience of the Synfuels program. The Carter administration thought it was a great idea to commit billions and billions of dollars to a strategic policy, a strategic technology. They elected Reagan. He actually hung on for a couple of years trying to keep the policy in place, but afterwards it was axed. Now, knowing that we have a system in which we do not have a consensus, what would you do as a private investor? Do you want your money to follow that government policy when you cannot depend on its reliability? I don't think so. So I think the United States in particular is not set up to engage in this selective policy. Rob mentioned, and this will be my final point, that there were a cadre of experienced people in the government in Taiwan who were engaged in this policy. In other words, they have a permanent civil service which has chosen experts, and they remain there for a long time. In China, the Communist Party, you can bet, has been there for a long time and is likely to be there for a long time. In the United States, will the people in the Commerce Department be there next year? I wouldn't bet on it.
Thank you. Now for the first affirmative rebuttal round, we have Clive Prestwith for 4 minutes.
Bob Lawrence mentioned in his earlier presentation that the Japanese decided, just kind of for no particular reason, decided that they were going to build cars in the U.S. They just did this as a matter of thinking this is a nice place to build cars. Well, I actually was involved in that decision. And I can tell you that that decision was as a result of the U.S. government telling the Japanese, if you guys don't put some car plants in the U.S., we're going to lock you out. That was industrial policy. And the reason that the Japanese auto industry is vibrant and made U.S. auto industry more vibrant is because we had an industrial policy in the early 1980s in that regard. I heard both Bob and Claude talk about the sophistication of neoclassical economists and the fact that they do recognize that there are marketing professionals and so forth. And I grant that Bob and Claude do. But I've just written a book coming out in May, and one of the things I did as part of that exercise was to review all of the Economics 101 textbooks, the major popular textbooks. I could find very little about marketing professionals, very little about adversarial trade. There's some, but not very much. So Rob is right. The average treasury official or journalist who's taken Econ 101 has basically been taught Adam Smith, David Ricardo, Hector Moline, and not much beyond that. The thing with Bob Solow is interesting. Bob Solow says he doesn't know which ones. Well, you know what? It doesn't matter. There are a lot of opportunities out there. The thing is to pick a few. If you do nothing, you're going to go nowhere. Private industry doesn't make all the right choices. The governments will make some mistakes. But I would say the track record of the government is pretty damn good. I mean, we've got the internet, the web browser, the relational databases, all kinds of things that have come out of the government industrial policy. Let's take a company like Intel, dominant in the semiconductor industry, one of the world's top industrial technological companies. I can tell you Intel nearly went belly up in the early 1980s. And Intel is here today in part because there were some government officials. In fact, some of those government officials changed, but there were some government officials who knew that it was important to do things to enable Intel to remain alive. And so there we are. And I'm troubled by this notion that we can't do it, that we're too political. Fact is that, as I said to begin with, we will make decisions. We will make decisions about allocation and budget and regulations. Because we have no policy criteria, because we have not thought about it in any coherent, systematic way, those decisions will be and are politicized. You want to get politics out of it, have a policy and a systematic approach to developing some coherent thinking. Thank you.
Thank you. For the final negative 4 minute rebuttal, we have Claude Barfield.
I'm going to leave any comment on what was just said to the discussion because I want to keep introducing other issues. One of the things that I think we ought to tease out, and this is much more in terms of Rob's writings and those of the Institute, is where is this limit, this complex situation? Rob talks about you've got to go beyond basic research. I don't actually disagree with that. He talks about targeted basic research, and past this quadrant. I know I'm speaking in code for some people, but I'm moving in a hurry. I don't have any disagreement with that. The book that we commissioned at AEI in the early 90s with Rosenberg and Nelson, national light emission systems. You looked at that, but that was really what a lot of nations were doing. But it is one thing to say that you know that there are areas of opportunity, or you guess that there are areas of opportunity in terms of research. It is another to get beyond that and to say that you ought to go, the government ought to be supporting proof of concept or demonstration projects. And there, what you get in a lot of the writings here is that is counted as research. I would say that in the complex world that we agree is there, we need to think about where are the limits. And I think one of the most chilling things in one of the papers that Robert commissioned was the writer applauded the fact that people at the CIA and the Commerce Department and the Defense Department were actually thinking as if they were venture capitalists. Well, you know, that's trouble, I think, down the road, and it will end in tears. So that's one thing. The second thing I want to underscore, Robert Lawrence began this, and that is that, and particularly when we're talking about the energy technologies that there's a lot of push to invest in today. And Clyde mentioned the fact that we're behind in batteries and we're behind in photovoltaics. Some of you, since this is an audience that's been around for a while, will remember a debate that I had with a very good economist over at the National Academy of Sciences in the 1990s, Kenneth Lamb. Lamb had done great work, I think, on trade policy, but in the Bush, in the Clinton administration, he was in charge of creating a flat panel industry out of the whole cloth. And basically, when I looked at the documents, I was starting to catch sacrificial lamb at the time. I couldn't find anybody to debate, and this was a highly popular program. What was clear from the Commerce Department and the White House documents was that this was not going to be, it was a stupendous, would have been a stupendous program for demonstration plants, 15% of the world market by the year 2000 or so. But buried in those documents was also a whole section on trade. And the point of this is we cannot allow the Japanese, but the Koreans who at that time were really moving into this area, to undercut us in price. And therefore, there will have to be a series of anti-dumping actions, countervailing duty actions. So I would argue that implicit in a lot of these, in the public investment for to advance technology is going to be a trade component. And particularly in the energy area, where there will be a lot of fights over the next half or even decade, there will be the idea that other nations are not doing this fairly, and that we must intervene not just for subsidy, but protection.
Thank you. With the final presentation and summing up the case, we have Rob Atkinson for the affirmative for 4 minutes.
All right, well, thank you. I want to thank our two opponents for making an elegant case. Fundamentally, I think that our position essentially is the right one. One of the key themes of this debate was that neoclassical economics understands their market failures and you know, what's the problem? Well, the problem is that there's this notion that these market failures are very discrete. They always pick one at a time, and that very sort of simple mechanisms can be used to address them. For example, Bob talks about a CO2 tax, and that would somehow bring about this nirvana of innovation in the green space. Let's just look at that for 1 second. There's a natural experiment that's been going on for the last couple of decades in Europe. It's called the gas tax. There's a $400 a ton carbon tax, a de facto carbon tax in Europe right now, and they have zero electric cars. All they do is they drive smaller cars and they ride their bicycles more. So price alone doesn't get you what you want. It doesn't get you innovation. The second component of this, I think, is that we would argue that the market failures are so significant that it really has to ultimately grow. Someone looking at this, it leads you into a different frame. It isn't simply a system where we can say, well, there's this failure here and we'll fix it with this little thing. Fundamentally, we have to, I would argue, abandon the neoclassical framework and start talking about what people in this field talk about are national innovation systems. We have a national innovation system in the U.S. We need to think about how to support that and how to advance that. The other component that I think the critique is, well, that experts, if experts are going to decide, Bob talked about, he said, well, if we can, quote, I think it was a quote, if you can do that, then the policy might be worth doing. And Claude talked about his support for Pastor's Quadrant, this notion of targeted. Well, let's look at what we have done in the U.S. We've done programs exactly like that. And these are the programs that have been vociferously criticized by neoclassical economists to get rid of them. For example, National Science Foundation Engineering Research Centers program, vastly underfunded program. The Microelectronics Advanced Research Corporation that DARPA established to build our semiconductor capability, highly successful program. Again, a program that picks a winner. DARPA has a shipbuilding industry program. Collaborative U.S., collaborative government-private sector. We have the Manufacturing Extension Partnership Program. We have the, what used to be called the Advanced Technology Program. There's a, I think it was Claude maybe, or Bob said, well, we don't have permanent civil servants like they do in Taiwan. Well, I'd call Mark Stanley as permanent as we can get. Mark runs the ATP program. I guess he's retiring at some point. That's pretty permanent. Mark's been around that program almost since the inception, 15, maybe 20 years. And that program, I would question anybody who would call that program a politicized program. The reason ATP was attacked, not that it was politicized, no one can make that claim about ATP. It was attacked because it explicitly picked winners. It picked technologies. So this notion somehow that we can't do it, it's going to be politicized, I would argue it's exactly the opposite. The reason we have problems in this country, Bob talked about Reagan axing Synfuels. Well, Reagan axed Synfuels because he bought into this neoclassical framework. If we had a consensus, which we don't, but if we had a consensus among all of us that said, yes, we can do this and we can do it the right way, then essentially I think we could get to a point where we could say we could do the right policies and do it in a way that is avoiding politicization. We have a track record with doing that. The only problem is these are small little experiments because they can never get the support from the dominant neoclassical camp. And if we could get that, I think we'd be in the right place.
So thank you, members of the affirmative and the negative. We're going to cast votes again in a few moments to see if the minds have been changed. But first, I'm going to take the moderator's prerogative of asking our team to draw out and expand on a couple of the issues that have been left on the table. As I'm sure, again, we've all been mapping the flow of ideas. So I'm going to ask one or two of these, and then we'll cast our votes to see whose minds have been changed. Then we'll have a question from the audience, a general discussion. I'm going to ask either member of the negative team who'd like to address this. A theme from the affirmative was, yes, you complain the government will do this badly, but in fact, if the government, that these decisions are being made all the time anyway, and the only thing worse than the government being is the government not intervening, and will be politics from other countries, de facto politicization, et cetera. What's your response to that?
Well,
thank you.
Okay. Right. Here we go. My response is to try. What we see is the government behaves in this way in all of the areas of our policy. So, in a sense, it's a chronic problem. What I am concerned about, particularly in this area, is that if we ramped it up on a significant scale, is that it would look just like the rest of our policies. And so it would look like the agricultural policies which we have. It would look like the energy policies which we're currently implementing. It would look like the healthcare policies. So my response is we don't need another fiasco in an area where the private sector is extremely good. This is an area in the allocation of resources where we do have a system, not perfect, not without the need of regulation, not without the need of the provision of public goods, but a system which works better than I believe the government is going to be able to do.
So a brief reply to that. Well, actually, no, I'm just going to ask about some issues for you all. One theme of the negatives argument, as you presented various examples of success, is a version of the old joke, well, that's all fine in practice, but what about in theory? That is, that there, you can find some various illustrations where you can contend this has been successful, but as a larger matter, these efforts will, over time, fail and be bogged down. Can you make the case that the specific examples you're talking about for successes, as you did, Rob Atkinson, in your closing statement, that these are more generally typical of the likely success of government policy and not anomalies?
Look, the problem with this debate is if we just sort of throw this spaghetti at the wall and say, oh, you know, something happens that's either good or bad,
we know very, very clearly how to design programs that effectively pick winners. We also know things how not to do it. And we can go back in history and look at programs that didn't follow these principles, and lo and behold, they didn't do well. And those are the policies and programs that tend to get picked up by the opponents of picking winners. But we know what works, and we also have lots and lots of case examples of ones I mentioned, the Focus Center program at DARPA, the Nano Initiative that the Clinton administration put in place, what we're going to be seeing here in our national broadband plan. We know how to design policies and programs the right way, and I think the question really is not about will these programs get bastardized somehow. Historically, they haven't. They've worked. They've continued to work. The debate has never been, has always been about, well, we don't want to even do these good programs because that's picking winners. Let's have a straight-up debate, and we would all agree, I think, that there are ways that are picking winners that are bad. I think the four of us would fully agree on a lot of those examples. But what I would hope we could do is that the four of us could also agree that there are ways and means and mechanisms of doing it the right way that have worked and that deserve all our collective support to make it work even more.
And that is a question to turn to the negative. Would you, if Rob Atkinson is stipulating that all four of you would agree, and probably everybody in the room, that there are bad examples, do you agree in principle there are good examples?
I don't think there are really good examples of the government taking things all the way through. And I would take, I mean, the things that are thrown around would be the internet. Yes, you started with DARPA research, but you really would not have had the government take this all the way into. You don't go from DARPA research to the new Apple gadget this past weekend. What you did with that was the private sector picked it up. I'm not arguing. This again is what is. I would disagree that we, or at least I would disagree. Robert can speak for himself. that we would agree that the government picked winners and let losers go. But it is in that middle ground. What can the government do to help a particular sector or stop others from hurting it that we will have the debate? What specifically? And I would argue that, yes, you go back to the point that I think Rob picked up on, and that is I see no problem with whether it's the NSF or NIH or whoever is doing the automobile research targeting areas that we don't know, that there is a public good. We don't know the science or the technology. Beyond that, I think I would disagree.
So a question now for the affirmative too. A constant theme from the negative was that, again, it is so difficult to find this transition point from supporting general research to having a kind of specific commercialization that Claude was just talking about now. That is there in principle a clean way to make this distinction? What would be your illustrations of that?
Bob made the point that it's not concerned about doing research, we're concerned that we also want the production to take place in the U.S. And my response to that is, well, wait, what's the point of doing research? I mean, if we're going to do research so that the fruits of research are production and jobs are all elsewhere, we're not going to do much research. Now, so how do you then follow through? And the answer is, coming back to my point on Andy, innovation is actually not that difficult. But what tends to happen is there was things that are called the valley of death between initial innovation and organization at scale. And it's in that valley of death where all kinds of things bad can happen to you. There may not be the infrastructure, may not be exactly right for you, may not have the roads in the right place, or the internet might not be fast enough, for example. Or the cost of capital might be very high for you, whereas your competitor being subsidized in Japan or Korea with cheap capital, or your exchange rate might be overvalued and makes production very difficult in your home base. So you move the production offshore where somebody is manipulating their exchange rate. So the answer is, let's have some investment tax credits. Let's have some coordination with government and industry. So the infrastructure needs are understood and attended to by the government. Let's have a currency policy that doesn't allow our currency to be manipulated and distorted. Let's have policies that deal with particularly the investment incentives, the capital grants, the free land, the free infrastructure that many other governments are offering to companies in the valley of death.
Robert, why don't you want to respond to that?
Yes. The question is, a fundamental question is, why are we doing the research? Now, suppose that what we're worried about is the environment. Suppose we're worried about CO2 emissions. If that is our goal, then we should try to achieve it at the lowest cost possible. And if it turns out that we come up with the innovation, but the product is more cheaply produced abroad, I believe we should do it. We have a biofuels program. We're trying to promote the use of biofuels because there is a view that somehow they're good for the environment. We can debate that question. But simultaneously, we've imposed a tax on the imports of sugar ethanol from Brazil. So what's our goal? Is our goal jobs? If our goal is jobs, let's subsidize employment, not technology. Let's take the taxes off employment. Let's give people relief from the taxes that are imposed when an employer makes a decision to hire somebody. So my view is we need to know what we want. We need to be precise about why we have these policies. Technologies are not a goal. Technologies are an instrument to achieving something. So let's be clear on what our goals are, and then let's choose the instruments that are most precisely targeted to those goals. I don't think we're doing it if we say we need technologies because we hope, or maybe we're going to have to take some measures to ensure that they're applied in our economy.
All right, so do you have a concise response to that?
Look, the goal is essentially productivity and innovation. We want new products and services, and we want high productivity. There is no doubt that the literature clearly states that that's related to technology, and not just about invention, but about diffusion through the entire system with a range of technologies. This notion somehow that we should be indifferent to where clean technology is made might be valid if we weren't talking about the need for innovation in technologies. If all we're talking about is this is like wheat or rye and it's some commodity, we only care about price on it, sure, okay, let's let it be made in China. That's not the problem. The problem is that Erica Fuchs has shown in a recent report that she did, what the Chinese essentially are doing is limiting next generation technologies. So we can get current generation solar panels from China. We can get current generation wind from China. Their subsidies, their currency, their trade protectionism, a whole set of other things mean that this next generation of clean tech that we need so desperately in the world just simply won't get developed. And we're the ones who need to be developing it because that is our Ricardian comparative advantage. So you can't just look at it from that's my other main complaint about neoclassical economics. It's very static. It's about consumer welfare today. We need to think about global welfare in the future and American welfare in the future.
I'm going to intervene for one other round of distilled questions and then our vote. I'm going to ask the members of the negative team, either one of you, what is the central point you think the other side did not address? I'm going to ask the other side to address that in two sentences, the main complaint they did not address, and then we'll have you address it.
Well, I think, basically, I think there's been no, at least for me, no explication or explanation of how one would choose the technologies. Well, how does one know? And how does one know enough to go beyond just the general kinds of support in terms of basic research and targeted research that we should go ahead with?
And a comparably concise response.
Well, the technologies are pretty much out there. I mean, we know that some technologies contribute to economies of scale, high productivity increases. We know that some of them contribute to multiple effects across the economy. The internet is an example of a technology that diffuses across the entire economy. But this is not such a hard thing. I mean, nanotechnology, biotechnology, advanced materials, you know, these are things that scientists and engineers and educated laymen know are going to have a big impact in the future. The question really is the United States going to play the role that it competitively could play? And this comes back to the weakness on the other side. Rob is right. It's a static analysis. It doesn't take into account the issue that the United States could be competitive, cost competitive, as well as technology competitive, in many, many of these areas. And the fact that it's not doing so is not because it doesn't have the resources or the capability or the market scale. It does. The fact it's not happening is because market distortions often imposed by foreign policies are preventing the U.S. from realizing the full benefit of its capabilities.
I'm going to take Clyde's statement as also the concise statement of what he thinks your side did not address. So what's the response to the second half of Clyde's?
Well, I think it is utter rubbish that
now we're
to be explicit, it is utter rubbish that economics concerns itself only about static efficiency and not dynamic efficiency. We have growth models, we have optimal control theory being used to see what is the optimal way to deal with things over time. And so I don't think that throwing in this notion of static versus dynamic helps this discussion. The whole point is we do need to create an environment which encourages innovation. We do need to have rewards for innovation. So we're not against government policies, whether they regulatory, whether they the patent system, whether they intellectual property protection, whether they are giving finance to the National Science Foundation and to basic research and to students to study science and math. All of those things are components on the supply side, which and in creating an environment in which we will see innovation. So those are the legitimate province of the government. Those are recognized public goods. That's where the thrust of the policy ought to be, rather than in the choice of specific technologies.
I just quickly say, one of the problems with the neoclassical argument is they can always say, you know, there's an NBER article in 1984 that mentioned this. Look, fundamentally, what we're talking about is what is the overall thrust of the neoclassical framework. My son recently took the AP test in macroeconomics.
Maybe you should go to
the very
university.
First statement in the text in the book was, and I didn't tell him not to read the book because it was all wrong. The very first one was, economics is about the efficient allocation of goods and services. That is principally what this is all about. That's not what economics should be about. Economics should be about how do we create added wealth.
Notice it didn't say at a point in time.
1 point, 10 seconds. If you go and you look at every single macroeconomics textbooks out there, the growth chapter, if there's one, which most of them don't even have a growth chapter, it's very, very small. There's very little about growth and innovation in neoclassical.
Nothing said. Just take that definition. The efficient allocation of resources. No one said at a point in time. It's the efficient allocation of resources currently and over time. That is what economics is about.
I'm going to ask at this point, before we have engaged the audience in discussion, it's time to vote again. So vote of your agreement or disagreement with the proposition. We will compare how those results stand with where an hour and a half ago. And so then our technological wizards will sort these things out. So who would like to raise a question for a member of the panel? Please identify yourself and state it in the form of a question. Yes.
Ken Jarville, Athena Alliance. First of all, thank you for this blast from the past.
And the future, too.
A full head of hair, and it's actually brown. as you guys know, I've been doing this stuff for a while. There's an element here that is hidden. It's come out a little bit, Claude, when you talked about, Bob, when you talked about trade. Rob talked about it with his example of the wind turbines. Are we going to make them here, or are we going to import them abroad? The producer versus consumer line. Now, what Charlie Schultz was really against in industrial policy was having a producer-oriented government policy because economic policy was all about maximizing consumer benefit, lowest cost. How do we frame this producer versus consumer divide in this industrial policy?
Who would like to address that concisely? Yes.
Well, I think it's a really, really important point. I think that what sometimes gets lost in the debate is wages and income. The thrust of Anglo-American economics has been consumer welfare producer. We always talk about, particularly in trade terms, that there are gains of trade outweigh the loss of others, the consumer benefits outweigh the lost jobs and industries and so on. What is not addressed is the fact that that there are negative impacts on wages and incomes as a result of many of these policies, or lack of these policies, and therefore that and this is a reason why most other countries, particularly rapidly developing countries, put a lot of emphasis on producer welfare, because their producer welfare raises productivity and incomes, which then allows greater consumption. And I think this is something, again, where neoclassical economics falls apart, because its focus is so narrowly and so intensely on the immediate, narrow, low-cost welfare.
We'll go back to the nonsense again. I mean, it's just simply not true. I'll let Robert speak.
Can you put your mic on?
I thought it was on.
Yeah.
Is it on now?
Yeah, on top.
It's simply not true that neoclassical economists or economists in general do not.
This one is different from the others. Maybe you can use that, Bob.
Do not think about what they think about is productivity and how do you increase productivity. And that has very little to do with the kinds of things we've been talking about, I think, this morning, about picking winners and losers. It has to do with some things that actually we do not disagree with Rob and maybe Cloud about, in terms of education, in terms of a better regulatory environment, in terms of getting a macroeconomic house in order. And so it's simply not true that we don't think about the wages. The wages are tied, if you look at the graphs, and that would be, and I think every economics 101 text, you look at wages and productivity over time, no matter what the country is, they rise together. There may be a flip back and forth over a couple of years. But secondly, to go back to the question that was asked about producers today, Robert started a little bit about this. I think one of the problems we have just in terms of producing, let's say, energy technology here, it goes back to Robert Reich's question some decades ago or a decade and a half ago, who is us? And with supply chains today, with our major multinational companies having to compete worldwide and having to site in various places, I mean, you've all seen these charts of a computer and where the components come from. The key for us is to keep the, as it were, the brain of that component. And that gets back to the kinds of things that we were talking about and that we actually haven't talked about in terms of our university system, in terms of I think the increased, commendable increase of the Obama administration basic research. I would say finally, though, in terms of resources, many of you I know are science and technology people, and you and I are living in a dream world because of what the Obama administration was able to do in its first year. It poured money in the NSF into other R&D programs, but we are heading for a huge crunch in terms of the budget, and that these programs are part of the discretionary spending, and there are going to be some huge decisions that we will have to make in terms of our research university system, and that's the kind of thing that maybe Rob and I and Clyde could agree about without getting into this stuff about going chasing any particular technology as the way in the future.
Yes.
This is a question for Rob.
Could you identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Charles Orlewek, but anyone can respond as well. You mentioned a little while ago a discussion at the Treasury Department around using tax policy to stimulate innovation. And I assume you meant companies' innovation and research and development and so forth and so on. What about the idea of looking at the individuals as well and using tax policy to try to stimulate individual investment in pursuing and earning degrees in engineering, science, and other STEM fields?
Well, I mean, I don't have a philosophical argument about that. I doubt Claude would have a philosophical argument about that. Whether that's the right way to get more people to do STEM is an interesting empirical question. I mean, it's not an ideological question. So maybe it's a good idea, maybe it's not. I haven't studied it. But let me shift your question a bit to, well, could we do tax policy for companies? But what we just heard was, but somehow the government doesn't know enough to pick winners, and that they really are looking at producers. Well, look, we do know, or at least I can be happy to point to 4 or 5 scholarly peer-reviewed academic articles in legitimate economic publications that show that the social spillovers from investments in information technology by companies are twice as high, or 100%, that they don't capture 100% of it. It's a market failure. So I guess my question to the panel would be, would you be willing to agree with me that what we need to do is have a tax policy that lets companies expense their investments in IT in the first year? clear market failure. We're using a neutral mechanism of tax that would say if you're investing in IT, you can expense it in the first year. That would drive productivity, would drive innovation.
Actually, I want to go one further. You see, the empirical evidence, and there is a lot of empirical evidence, that private innovators, not only in information technology, but private investments in R&D tend to have half the return that is the return to society. So the logical implication is we want people to do more innovation and more expenditures on R&D. The right approach is a tax credit or a subsidy somehow to enhance what they would do otherwise. So I'm in favor of it. But I'm not in favor of isolating it on information technology. Try to find what information technology is, for instance, and you'll see what a headache you'll have. So it's the idea that the government picks where the winners are, as opposed to the government isolates where the market failures are and then compensates. The nature of the market failure we're trying to deal with is insufficient innovation. And therefore, our instruments and our policies should be precisely targeted to where what we think the fundamental problem is. So I am actually quite in favor of something like an R&D tax credit. And I don't know, quite honestly, whether the social returns are going to be greater if someone spends the next dollar in information technology or if they figure out somehow, you know, to make a better widget. I don't know where that is going to be. I'd like the private sector to do it. I think the genius of the American system in charity is that the government doesn't decide where individuals should give their money, but the government gives a tax break in order to encourage them to engage in socially beneficial activities. That's the kind of technology stimulus that I would like to see, not picking where they spend it.
I will go on record right now, and I will risk my entire future career on this statement, that there are bigger spillovers to IT when a company invests in it than when they buy a couch. We should be treating furniture expenditures by companies, which are seen as an investment, and they can write those off with depreciation schedules. We should be treating IT differently than furniture. Now, Bob, I'm willing to say maybe we should include machinery, but are you saying fundamentally that furniture is the
research,
same as machinery?
Research is what I'm saying. So
I'm talking about investment.
We have a great difference. Let's just make it clear. You think if someone goes out and buys a computer, the government should subsidize that investment rather than if they go out and buy a machine. Okay? Right? That's or a couch, for that matter. That's what you think. Okay? I don't. Because the spillovers are not simply to a purchase of a computer. In my view, the spillovers come from what is called research. Okay? Doing investigations on what is going to be profitable with innovation. That's what I want to encourage, not just investment.
I just wanted to say, though, that my question about individual motivation has kind of somehow morphed into a discussion about companies. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on motivate, because, you know, the fact is that there were more bachelor's degrees earned in information technology in the United States in the 1985-86 school year than there were in 2006-2007. So that's the big picture, and it's about motivating more individuals.
I like your pointing out to come down to the level of the individual. I think that people should be able to operate like small businesses and to deduct the expenses for their educations more broadly.
But what about a special tax incentive for STEM?
Well, I don't want the government to pick winners.
So, yes, we have a question.
Well, I think this reminds me, though, of proposed that Paul Romer had some years ago where he suggested that rather than target universities, you actually target graduate students individually. And I think that had a lot of sense. So they could take the money and go wherever they wanted. The government broadly would go across various scientific fields. The universities were not very happy with that. And one can understand why.
But Claude, are you willing to say, as I would, that I like that policy, and I think when Homer came up with that, but I would only target it to STEM. I don't think we need to subsidize people getting a PhD in French literature.
Yeah. Well, this will target. There's a difference between just information technology as a narrow field versus all of science and all of science disciplines.
Right.
Yes, sir.
Hi, Gene Kilby. Didn't we do a little bit of both? Didn't we target some industries and motivate people to study as a result of Sputnik? Didn't we direct research and what have you into the technology companies, the aerospace companies, and motivate people to do science and engineering degrees?
Yes, of course we did. But the thing early on was that the U.S. has a long history of industrial policy. I mean, really, from historically, look at the U.S. from about 1815 until 1950, we pretty much acted like China is acting today.
Well, my point being is that that direction and that emphasis paid off hugely in jobs and all kinds of spillover.
Well, there are two things to keep in mind. You're mixing two kinds of programs in the late 50s and early 60s. One was it certainly did produce a spate, this new graduate, a subsidy of graduate education in science and technology, particularly the space science. And secondly, you had a specific target there, a hardware target of getting to the moon. And that's what we were spending money for. And surely you had, one could debate, I mean, NASA has probably always sold the spin-offs, but there was certainly some there. But that was a clear target of a particular technological goal, as opposed to, say, energy policy that has other things beyond just the hardware that you're creating.
But the spin-off of a much higher degree of computer technology, miniaturization of electronics, and it led to all other.
So I'm going to interrupt here with two housekeeping items before more questions. Steve is going to come up in a moment and tell us the results of the polling. There were a variety of conflicting times of when we were actually going to end. By executive decision, we'll end at 11:15. So we'll have a lightning round of extra questions, and then people will hang around for more discussion. So quick questions and quick answers. Yes.
I'm Ron Stoltz from Sandia National Laboratory. So thank you for mentioning picking losers, because that's really what the semi-permanent cadre of researchers in the national labs do. We identify losers. But my question for both sides is, what is the time frame and what is the process for arriving at a time frame for your expectation of assessment about winning and losing? And I hadn't heard that at all through the discussion.
How about from the affirmative team first? How do you know if this worked or not?
If you have success, it's not like we're not wanting to. If that's working, given the big time, I don't know the right time frame for, but let's say 10 to 15 years. So if it's working after 10 to 15, after 10 to 15 years, you want to be seeing that you've reached predetermined goals. So if you have your research in nanotechnology, the researchers are going to set goals, reach those goals. If part of those goals include commercialization, are they commercialized? I don't think that's so difficult.
You also build informal evaluation from the get-go. You have groups like the National Academy of Sciences evaluate these programs, or other groups that are objective and look at it on an ongoing basis.
I think that's a great question, because I think it's extremely difficult, and things are always changing. The future keeps changing, you know. What we think we know today, what we think we knew 6 months ago, it's remarkable how things change. So this is the great pitfall of putting a lot of government resources into the objective of commercialization. It turns out that most projects, Mansfield, Pennsylvania, did a study. It was really interesting. Most innovative projects within companies reach their technological goals, but they fail commercially. And if our goal here is commerce, we're in trouble because there's going to be a panel, these experts are going to tell us, oh, we're doing fine technologically. What they haven't really got a good idea of is it's going to succeed in the market.
If I could ask, I mean, implicit in this discussion, the notion that we're talking here about backing particular companies or backing a specific commercialization. I don't think that's what we're talking about. We're not talking for a big government expenditure. Now, you can have a very effective
industrial policy without spending much money. How you do your regulatory stuff, how you do your direct your purchasing, that's much more powerful than any kind of subsidy that you might get. So I think the point that we're trying to make is we want the government to be active in backing technologies, and we want the government to be active in compensating for market failures or in countering market distortions.
Well, wait, that's a scholarly good in terms of what you earlier talked about. We talked about
make this point in 30 seconds.
Getting up through demonstration programs. We talked about the bureaucracy as a venture capitalist. I mean, this is specific. Somebody has. It's in Rob's paper that you actually should go into. That's got to be a particular company at some point. You don't have a consortia of companies. As a matter of fact, in terms of another quick thing, in terms of some things that Rob pointed to, and I would have no problem with this depending on what you're talking about, and that is support for consortia. I don't have any problem with support for consortia as long as it's research. And one of the rules we should have is, yeah, the government will support consortia, but there'll be no intellectual property come out of this. Or it has to be all widely licensed. Because that is the only argument from a public good stance, that this has to be widely distributed in the economy so every company gets to it. You do that, maybe I have less problems.
So I'm going to take three questions, which we'll do seriatim, and then we'll get the answers to all of them so we can get them in. Yes.
David Wallace, Georgetown University. Could the affirmative side give an example of a failed industrial policy, and could the negative side give an example of a successful government policy, and what did you learn from that counterexample?
Good question, yes. Okay, another one to put on the table. Any others, or will this be our wrap-up question? Okay, well, that's a very good final question. So affirmative. Give us an example of a failure. Negative, give us an example of success.
Yeah, we both had the same one. Synfuels. Failed industrial policy in part because it was ill-designed and didn't have the analytical backing to support it. And it also failed one of the key things that we focused on in our position, which is you don't want to target so narrowly. Clearly, what we should have been doing in the 80s was focusing much more on renewable energies and clean energies. That's what we should have been doing. So when Synfuels comes up, it's sort of an example to me of, okay, we did it wrong. But we know how to do things wrong, and we know how to do things right. This isn't all that complicated. And the notion that Bob says that this world is way too complex, then if it's way too complex, why don't we just disband economics? Why don't we get rid of the Federal Reserve? Why don't we get rid of the entire federal government? Because it's just too complex. We're supposed to be able to deal with complexity. That's what analysis is about. And I think we do know how to do things. So, I think there have been clear failures, but we know and we learn from them. They shouldn't damn the entire enterprise.
And an example of a success and what we've learned from
I'm going to redefine it in the sense that I think certainly in terms of my terms, the terms that I talked about earlier, when you're talking about targeting the base of research, yes, it made a lot of sense for the Defense Department to, for its own reasons, to fund materials research, or research early on in the 50s and 60s related to, high-end computing. It did not then go beyond that. It did, for some purposes it did, but that was then handed off. So I consider that, this is not your normal view of industrial policy, but that kind of targeting of government money going to things where you did not know there were lots of physical characteristics of materials you didn't know about. And there are lots of things about computing you didn't know about in terms of chips or things like that. I have no problem with that. I would consider that a success, and that's what I was talking about when I talked about.
And would you affirmatively consider the existence of the U.S. aviation and aerospace industry an example of successful industrial policy?
Negative.
You said affirmative.
The negative.
Yes, the negative. Yeah. Sure. Again, we'll go ahead. You have to.
Well, yes, you see, it also goes back to the space idea. I want to make a distinction. The government has an interest in certain kinds of purchases. The government wanted to be us to be able to fly. Okay, so the government invested in that. That's perfectly legitimate. That's in a sense a demand-driven desire on the part of a buyer who knows what they want. The problem is when you try to anticipate what the market will want. So there will be spillovers when the government spends its money. As long as the government is directing it towards a socially legitimate objective, and I think in the case of, you know, the development of jet aircraft, given military needs, that was a perfectly legitimate objective, and it had immense spillovers. That's fine. It was a technology policy, but it wasn't targeted on competitiveness or on commercialization.
Okay, a last brief word to the affirmative, as is typical, and then we'll hear the results.
Well, first of all, I do think we need to go beyond research and intervene in industry. An example would be in the mobile payments industry, where Japan and Korea are so far ahead of us moving down that path. We have none of it here. We're not going to get any of it here. Or if we get it, it'll be the wrong technology, because firms alone are not going to develop this technology. But leaving that aside, let's just forget all that and stipulate, Claude, that what we're talking about is strategic research or the past year's quadrant. If we could all agree on this panel that the result of this debate is that we think government should do a lot more of that, I would be incredibly thrilled, because I frankly don't see the debate on this in Washington among the other side coming to the table and saying, yeah, we do need to do more strategic research. So I'm pleased to hear you say that, but I just don't hear it in the broader debate. I hear that as picking winners. We shouldn't have a program on robotics research and research or other things like that. I'm not talking about should we fund robotics companies. I'm saying robotics research program. So if we can agree to that, to me, I would be thrilled. I think that's a success for the day.
So let's agree on things we can agree on. First, there is much more to say on this topic, and there will be things to say about it over the years. Second, that we've had a really admirable and impressive and enlightening job by our panelists, for which I thank them all. And third, that we're now going to hear what this all means, because Steve Norton will come and give us the results, where minds change one way or the other. Steve, can tell us what we're waiting to hear.
Well, I don't know whether it was hometown advantage or force of argument, fraud. The technology is impressive. I can't vouch for the scientific accuracy of the poll, but we have a little movement in our thinking. Our pre-debate poll was 48% agreed that we should have an industrial policy of sorts, 28% disagreed, and 24% were undecided. So we ended up with some movement in favor of agreement. We have 60, 25, and 15. So, rather surprisingly, Washington's minds might have been changed this morning.
So thank you all. Thanks to our debaters. Thanks to the host organizations. Thanks to all of you who have come, and we appreciate it. And to be continued, this discussion.
And also thanks to Jim for a wonderful job you did. Thank you.
Yeah.